ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. The Senate inquiry into the proposed Middle Arm Industrial Precinct is heating up in Darwin today, it would seem.
You can't complain about a wait time at a hospital or funding for education if you don't support Middle Arm.
Can I ask the Chief?
Yeah, the Territory Government has today provided evidence to the inquiry, which you'll hear in a moment. We'll also take a closer look at who's been snubbed by this Senate inquiry. Quite amazing who's in and who is out. Also today, some tips on how to avoid an online scam that appears to be targeting farmers. This is all coming up on the Country Hour. We are broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC, streaming online, and g'day to those who have downloaded the podcast. We start today's program talking about Wagyu beef. One of my favourite topics. The annual Wagyu Association Conference is on at the moment in Cairns. And one of the key speakers today is Troy Setter, the Chief Executive of Consolidated Pastoral Company. Now, CPC runs more than 300,000 head of cattle across stations in Queensland, the Territory and WA. And of course, was once owned by Kerry Packer and Ken Warriner, who famously bred up that large herd of grey Brahmins. But as Troy Setter explains, CPC started putting Wagyu genetics into its herd back in 2017, and he says it's paying off.
We introduced Wagyu for a couple of reasons. One, it's a really important part of the Australian beef industry with quite a bit of value. So we've got some Angus cross Wagyu F1 cattle, and they're performing really well. And then we also wanted to put some Wagyu genetics into our northern composite to increase our fertility and productivity, and also give us some other market options.
And fertility was a big point that you made in your speech. What impacts have introducing the Wagyu genetics had into the fertility?
They've certainly helped reduce the lactational anaestrus, so the cows will cycle and lactate at the same time that have got the Wagyu genetics in them. We've also reduced the age of first calf joining and first calf calving, and increased our rebreed rates.
You said that the Wagyu Brahmin cross embryos were coming out a bit tougher as well. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think it is. When I say tougher, the survivability of crossbred cattle compared to purebred cattle is always a bit higher, but we've really seen those Wagyu Brahmin crosses survive really well.
You can get quite extreme conditions up in northern Australia, so you really do need cattle that can tough it out, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to keep the Bos indicus content fairly high, and we've got to ensure that the other breeds that we send up, whether Wagyu or Angus, are absolutely suited to those conditions and got, you know, slick coats and heat tolerant and are the right type of animal.
Mm. And are those quite delicious Wagyu characteristics coming through in the meat, both in the Angus cross and the northern composite cross?
Yeah, absolutely. The meat's really good quality, and I think that the test is the staff on our stations will much prefer to eat the Wagyu or Angus cross than some of the older cattle that we were asking them to eat in the past.
Look, you also mentioned that the horns in the female cattle were slowing growth. Could you explain what that point was about?
Yeah, so we really need our heifers in northern Australia to get to breeding weight as quick as possible so that they hit puberty and also time that for the wet season where we want them to be joined. And if we're knocking 10 to 15 kilos off an animal by dehorning it, that can delay that onset of puberty and that weight gain. And ultimately too, it's not just an economic reason, but from an ethical reason, we've had a program now for about 10 years of trying to breed more pole cattle, and where we haven't been able to, we're using pain relief.
Yeah, and sort of bringing all of this together, have you had any major setbacks or challenges introducing the genetics?
Look, there's been some challenges with markets and customers that were used to getting higher Brahmin content cattle. Certainly the walking distances between yards are challenging, and our staff have done a great job doing some extra work at times with some of the crossbred cattle. But we've also seen some new markets and new buyers, and so overall it's been quite positive.
And speaking of markets, I suppose tying in a a sort of a regular, everyday type of beef like Angus with luxury Wagyu, what market are you aiming for?
Look, we've got about 300,000 cattle, so we target a variety of markets from the F1 high-quality Angus Wagyu cross through to, we still sell a lot of old cull cows every year that go into grinding beef to the US and everything in between. So we're trying to keep some diversity in our markets, but also keep an eye on what the consumer of the future is after.
Yeah, and what percent of your herd would have Wagyu genetics, and are you looking to increase that?
Look, today we're probably sitting at about 15-16% have got some Wagyu genetics coming through, and that'll increase over the next few years. But when we think about Wagyu in our herd, in our northern breeding herd, it's a variety of breeds put together, and the Wagyu certainly helps for fertility and helps with some of the eating quality. And then we've got some growth coming through with Angus and the Brahman and Bran as well.
What about the cost of sourcing those Wagyu genetics?
The same price as any other bull, really, for us or genetics, and we use a fair bit of AI and IVF in our studs, so the cost is pretty immaterial compared to other breeds of cattle.
Do you expect you'll continue to keep Wagyu in the herd?
Look, I think so. We work on a fair bit of performance, and you've got to perform to stay in the herd, and so there'll be some natural selection that goes through, not just from mortality but actual physical performance. So there's probably more variation within a breed than there is between breeds, so that we're a bit breed agnostic, and we're just trying to breed the type of cattle that suit Northern Australia but also suit customers at the same time.
That is Troy Setter, who heads up the Consolidated Pastoral Company, speaking to Bridget Herman at the Wagyu Association Conference, which is on this week in Cairns. Troy, one of the keynote speakers at this year's event. Now, tonight there in Cairns, the Elite Wagyu Sale Auction will be held. It'll be very interesting to see what sort of prices Wagyu cattle are fetching at the moment. The Wagyu Association's branded beef competition, it has announced this year's winners. I've been looking at pictures of the winning steaks this morning, and my goodness, I'm hungry. Just staring at this beef. Well done to Mayura Station in South Australia, which has been named the grand champion for its signature series steak. Judges' comments, I'll share this with you. It said, the judges said this beef had exceptional melt-in-your-mouth juiciness with lasting umami flavours and a satisfying silky mouth feel. This was bred by Mayuru Station themselves. The entry contained 60% marbling, with a marbling score of 8 and an eye muscle area of 154 centimetres square, which apparently, quote, blew the competition out of the water. So well done to Mayura Station in South Australia. And I'm sure on tomorrow's Country Hour, we'll bring you all the results from that Elite Wagyu sale. It is 22-1. There's been some interesting comments made today in the Senate inquiry that's looking into the proposed Middle Arm Industrial Precinct. We'll share the latest news with you next after some Fenny Lumsden.
G'day, my name's Amy Snowden. I celebrate Australian agriculture using Lego, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon. The Senate inquiry into the proposed Middle Arm Industrial Precinct is on in Darwin this week. This is a project which the federal government has committed $1.5 billion to, and it's under the microscope. Dan Fitzgerald has been tuning in to this Senate inquiry today. What's been happening, Dan?
Well, the NT government was up in front of the inquiry at 9 a.m. this morning, mm-hmm. Matt, with the Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, the Infrastructure Commissioner and the Chief Health Officer, and they all defended the work that the NT government has done in this proposed industrial precinct in Darwin Harbour. And there were some fairly heated questions from Green Senators and Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe. Chief Minister Eva Lawler's main message was that she believes the NT needs middle arm development to create jobs and revenue for the territory.
Projects like middle arm provide additional large increase in population, which we need. An increase in population means more GST, but it means ongoing, secure, good jobs for Territorians, about $20,000 of those, let alone then the revenue that'll come in for the Northern Territory. As I said, between $200 to $700 million in the long term annually would be fantastic money for us to be able to spend on education, on housing, on health. You can't complain about a wait time at a hospital or funding for education if you don't support middle arm.
Could I ask the Chief?
Ooh, sounds like a bit of a crowd there, Dan Fitzgerald. Bit of heckling from the back.
Yeah, there was a bit of that going on this morning, Matt. Mm-hmm. I'm being told there's up to maybe 200 people in the room there listening into the inquiry, making a few interjections along the way.
Sharing their thoughts,
yeah,
yes.
There was also a protest out on the Esplanade this morning for people who are against this middle arm development. And one of the big issues that those who aren't in favour of this have been raising is about the potential health impacts from the middle arm development. Doctors have spoken out about concerns on Darwin and Palmerston's air quality. Now, Chief Minister Eva Vallula, she responded to Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young's questions about this by saying that she believes the greatest health impact to Darwin's air quality actually comes from fires.
Senator, the biggest impact at the moment in the Northern Territory, in the Greater Darwin area, to our air is the particles from bushfires in the Northern Territory. So if you come up again, and you're more than welcome to come up again in June, July, when our fire season's probably in full swing, you will see the smoke that comes from the bushfires that burn through Arnhem Land. So, yes, I know you're obviously concerned about the health impacts. Absolutely, we are as well. I find it really ironic that senators from outside of the Northern Territory are concerned about the health impacts, because I can tell you here, every single one of us absolutely would never do anything to impact the health of Territorians. I was born in the Northern Territory. I've got grandchildren. I actually live in Palmerston, so I'm probably the only one out of these two rows that live in Palmerston. Actually, Louise lives in Palmerston with me as well. Of course, we would do nothing to jeopardise the health of Territorians. Absolutely, that's the work that will be done around the impact of health.
Health is the key issue that your local community has raised with this. We have had hundreds of submissions, hundreds of them, and health is, you know, right up there as a key concern.
And do you think we don't know that, Sarah, Senator? Of course we know that. We are on the ground. We have had numerous sessions in shopping centres. My electorate's in a shopping centre. We have those conversations with people from Darwin. It's mainly Darwinites that are having those conversations, Darwin and Palmerston people. So you coming here and telling us that, you're not telling us anything that we don't know. And that's the work that we're undertaking now, to make sure that we can be very clear and assure Territorians that the impacts will not be on their health from the middle arm precinct.
The Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, answering questions there from Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. She's the chair of this inquiry. One of the other senators who have been asking questions this morning is the independent senator from the ACT, David Pocock. He's been a vocal critic of the middle arm development for quite some time. Let's have a listen to his question to the Chief Minister.
And Chief Minister, you told us earlier that people can't complain about health or education or housing and not support the middle arm. And yet one of your own technical assessments shows that there is a high risk of reduced health and safety due to pollution, a high risk of increased road trauma, a high risk of reduced marine safety, a high risk of pressure on the affordability of quality housing in the region, a very high risk of reduced pressure on water supply, leading to scarcity, a high risk of reduced quality of life for Darwin residents due to noise, vibrations, dust, light pollution and smells, a high risk of saturation of short-term accommodation in Greater Darwin to house FIFO workers, goodbye tourism, a high risk of loss of trust and confidence in the public's ability to influence political decision-making. I mean, is this one of the 200 technical studies that you've referenced? And if so, how can you claim that studies have consistently backed the development? They seem like serious, serious risks.
Order. again, any study that's done looks at the full range of impacts that any development has in the Northern Territory. So that provides what you've just read out, the high end, obviously, of those risks. But there are, again, there's considerable work that's been done, those 200 studies. That's the work of our government agencies. That's the work around minimising the impact around all of those.
I'm running out of time. That wasn't my question, though. You've said
what
that...
What was your question?
The 200 studies consistently back it. I'd love to table this for the committee because this certainly doesn't back Middle Arm Petrochemical Hub. This raises serious concerns that $1.5 billion of federal government money is unlocking fracking in the Beetaloo and dire consequences for your constituents in Palmerston.
So, Senator Pocock, as I said, you use obviously extreme language. We often hear that coming
extreme
from
language
you.
Is in your very own report, the, Chief Minister.
This is your report. You stand
Order.
By.
So, again, there's 200 surveys that have been done, the environmental assessments, all of that's work that's been done. The vast majority show that the impacts for the Northern Territory are impacts that can be managed.
Eva Lawler, the Chief Minister there, speaking with the independent ACT Senator David Pocock. And this inquiry, Matt, it's had quite some trouble keeping to its timetable so far. The NT government's evidence, it ran about an hour over its scheduled time.
They're just loving it.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Up after the government was a few environment groups. The Environment Centre NT, its director, Kirsty Howey, answered a bunch of questions from the panel. And she said while she conceded there will be at least one renewable energy project related to the Middle Arm development, she said there will still also be a lot of carbon emissions.
I'm not denying that one of the proponents at Middle Arm is battery production. Mm. Absolutely not denying that. However, there is also no doubt that this project was designed at all times to enable the development of the Beetaloo Basin, which will generate 1.2 billion tonnes of carbon emissions if it goes ahead. Middle Arm will also involve the creation of a carbon capture and storage facility that could greenwash multiple other offshore projects, including Santos's Barossa project, which you've referred to this morning, which will generate 380 million tonnes of carbon emissions, and the Evans Shoal, or rebranded Verus Field, which has something like close to 30% of greenhouse gas emissions. If this project goes ahead, there's no amount of critical minerals, battery processing, or greenwashing renewable energy that can greenwash this project out of the basic fact that it will enable fossil fuel expansion on a huge level here in the Northern Territory that will consign us to unlivability.
So what I want to understand...
Order. That is Kirsty Howey from the Environment Centre speaking there at this Middle Arm inquiry this morning. It's I think it's just taking a break for lunch now, Matt. But this inquiry is also set to hear today from the NT Environment Protection Authority, the EPA, Charles Darwin University, some doctors, medical organisations, the Larrakia Development Corporation, the Northern Land Council, and education unions. A bunch of people are appearing today.
Someone here on the text, Dan, says, is that Pocock for real? FIFO workers means bye-bye tourism. Did he really say that, or was I hearing things? Is that what he said?
Yeah, and I think he was referring there to the competition for hotels and accommodation is maybe what he was getting at.
Right, right. 0487991057 is our text number if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon. We're talking about this proposed Middle Arm industrial precinct. It's under the microscope at the moment through this Senate inquiry. The inquiry has come under a bit of criticism on who it's listening to and who it perhaps is ignoring. So, for example, the committee today is hearing evidence from the chief executive of GetUp Australia, who has flown to Darwin for this public hearing, and yet the committee has snubbed a request from the chief executive of AFANT to appear. So GetUp Australia, which is sort of a left-wing advocacy group, it's speaking to the senators today. But the head of the Amateur Fishermen's Association of the Northern Territory, who wrote in his public submission that he'd welcome an invitation to be heard by the committee, he hasn't got an invitation. His request to appear at this has been ignored, it would seem. David Chirovolo was on ABC Radio this morning and says the committee simply does not want to hear what he says are uncomfortable realities.
So it's very, very important that there is a full justification of each part of this. And whilst we absolutely welcome $1.5 billion of Commonwealth infrastructure money to be spent here in the Territory and potentially at Middle Arm, we just want to make sure that that the influence around the election of concerns over foreign ownership of the existing Darwin port wasn't the reason that that money was put up, and that they can look at it with fresh eyes. And if they say, yes, it's absolutely port development, then they've got a whole lot of offsets they're going to need to do for recreational fishing and for environmental reasons. But if they could use that money for other enabling infrastructure at Middle Arm, we would just encourage them to really look very carefully at that. And I'm not really surprised that neither the Greens or the Commonwealth Government or the opposition really want to look at that, because I don't think it fits with their narratives.
Have you been able to make this case directly to the senators? Do you want to make that case?
Oh, look, Rick, we've, as I said, we've made a detailed submission. We represent an industry with 60,000 Territorian participants. We've got a whole range of businesses. 30% of all recreational fishing occurs on Darwin Harbour, and it's an almost $300 million industry. So it's very strange, I think, that they didn't want to talk to us here in Darwin. The inquiry is in some ways a political exercise, or in many ways a political exercise. And when they are picking the people who they want to hear from, often that what they do is they pick the people that they want to hear from. And so I think maybe the things that we're talking about, things that we're raising, more sort of strategic questions around Middle Arm, but also some uncomfortable realities that are not necessarily just pure green perspectives, but are environmental and are community-based social value perspectives, are a level of complexity that maybe they don't want to hear.
That's David Tarovolo from the Amateur Fishermen's Association of the Northern Territory. He'd like to be giving evidence today to this Senate inquiry, but he did not get an invite. Meanwhile, Tamboran Resources, which is the gas company with the biggest stake in the Beetaloo Basin and is the company that's got plans to build an LNG facility at Middle Arm, it's also been denied an invitation to speak on social media. Tamboran has written, I'll share this with you now, it says, for Senator Hanson Young or anyone else to state the gas industry was not willing to appear at the Middle Arm inquiry in Darwin is false. Tamboran told the Senate committee as early as last year that we would appear, had provided confirmation of attendance and witness names. As late as last Friday, we were told to expect a formal invitation to appear on April 11. However, on Sunday afternoon, we were told we weren't on the agenda and dropped by the committee without warning or explanation. As it stands, this hearing is an echo chamber for radicals, says Tamboran. We will relish the opportunity to appear and make the case for the 20,000 industry and manufacturing jobs in Middle Arm, whether that be appearing in the Territory, Canberra, or anywhere else for that matter, says Tamboran this afternoon. Now, just quickly before we go to the 1 o'clock news, once a month on the Country Hour, we like to check out how aquifers are faring in Darwin's rural area. Adrian Costa, how are things looking at the moment?
Yeah, Matt, they're looking really, really good. As your listeners would know, we've had a fair bit of rain right across the Territory. In fact, Darwin and Catherine, Tennant Creek and Alice Springs, and Tennant Creek and Alice Springs have had a huge amount of rainfall for what they would expect at this time of year. But in terms of the Darwin Rural area, we focus on the Howard system, and that's seen a rise of almost a metre over the last month, and some areas over 2 metres. But those aquifers are really getting at their capacity now. They don't have a lot of storage. They're a fill and spill type of aquifer. So we've got a lot of monitoring happening there. Berry Springs is another system. Again, that hasn't risen as much as perhaps the Howard system. But again, that's really at its capacity. And we rely on a couple of bores. Well, we've got a large amount of monitoring in that area. But in particular, your listeners would know we've got a number of signs in the area and, data that dates back almost 50 years in the Howard system and 30 years in the Berry Springs system.
At the moment, it feels like there's not much rain left in the wet season. So the aquifers in Darwin's rural area, have they got enough in them to survive maybe another 6-7 months without a single drop?
Oh, you're certainly right. I mean, look, in the dry season, I consider it almost like a bit of a 5 or 6 month drought. So we really need to be conscious of our water use. We know in Darwin, we use double the national average, which is not great. So people should consider, you know, checking any water leaks and checking the irrigation systems. But look, where the aquifers sit at the moment, they're at capacity. They're looking a lot better than the last couple of years, which is great. They've peaked sort of mid-March, and from here on in, obviously we won't get, or we'll get limited rain perhaps, and we'll be relying on that. So it's always a case of making sure that we don't overuse, and that we're really conscious about our water, because it could be a 5 or 6 month stint until we get those rains in the early part of the wet season.
Right, but it's starting off at a very high point, which is good.
It's looking pretty good. Yeah, absolutely. You know, things are looking really, really good.
And for irrigators in the Katherine region, when should they expect their final notification on how much water they're allowed to use this year?
Well, look, the notice is actually being posted onto our website, and we'll be contacting those landowners through a letter this month. We've made the decision, or the water control has made the decision, and there'll be no cuts this season. As we've talked about, we do a regional update in the back end of the previous year. We do an early notice around February, March this year, and we need to put the notice up before the 1st of May. But look, we do our modelling right from January, and we have a look at what's happening. And, you know, those last bit of rains in the Daly River area, the Ulu Dollarstone, way back in January, I think they had about 750 mils, has certainly boosted that section. So, yeah, look, things are looking really, really good, and those that notice is actually already up, and licence holders will get a letter soon.
Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, not a problem, Matt. Anytime.
Cheers. Adrian Costa, he's the Director of Water Assessment. We've got to go to the newsroom because it's 1 o'clock. See you back here in 5 for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
Matt's Turtle, cattle class, tow drive for Sherbert Livestock. We're all flat out. Give us plenty of room on the road, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll get some tips on how to avoid an online scam that appears to be targeting farmers. Make sure you stick around for that. You'll also hear from a cattle station south of Tennant Creek, which lost a lot of country last year to those horrific bushfires. But this year already has had nearly 1,000 millimetres of rain, and the country has bounced back big time.
No, to see the country respond to what it is now is pretty damn incredible. And the rivers, the water holes and everything are going to be full now for several years, which is a good sign. Or it's, you know, it's easy to manage a cattle station when it's raining.
That story before 1:30. And we're hearing from you this afternoon on 0487 99 1057 in the first half of the program. We were hearing all kinds of voices from the Senate inquiry into the proposed Middlearm Industrial Precinct. Someone texted the program questioning why David Pocock's worried about FIFO workers, saying that it would be the end of tourism. And in response, Graham writes here, he says, Matt, I was in the room when Lauren Moss apologised to the tourism industry for damage caused to it by the INPEX project. The damage that these mega projects do to existing economy elements is well documented, says Graham. Someone else here says, how many times have environmental groups been left out of business meetings? This is coming through on 0487 99 1057 if you'd like to join the conversation about Middlearm or maybe talk about Wagyu. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
That's the go. Just when it feels like the dry season is here and there's perhaps no more rain on the horizon, Gove Airport goes and gets an inch, 25 millimetres, and Cyclone Paul has whooped itself up into northern waters. What can you tell us about the cyclone?
Well, it's probably a good reminder that the cyclone season goes right through to the end of April. It's currently way out in the Coral Sea, so it's past the Solomon Islands, is heading away for the next 24 hours or so. It's Category 2 at the moment, strengthens a little bit, then it does a U-turn in about 24 hours' time and comes back towards the Australia, but it is weakening out, so it's not going to, it's unlikely to impact Australia as a cyclone. And the weak low will possibly dissipate in the Timor Sea, sorry, in the Arafura Sea. So we've got this burst of rain coming through, that rain that caused that good rainfall at Nhulunbuy Gove Airport's going to work its way across. Then we'll have a little bit of an easing as that easterly surge pulse moves on, for possibly a week, helped by a bit of a weak low or trough coming across as well. And then next week we'll see the weather picking up again, which is probably just the remains of Paul coming across.
Okay, so the cyclone unlikely to impact Australia, but could the Gulf country see a little bit of moisture because of it?
Yeah, it's going to bring, as it comes across, it's going to bring a little bit of that moisture across with it. So we're going to see, but maybe not quite down into the Gulf country, the western top end and the coastal areas of the Gulf country might see something. Mm-hmm. It may, there's indications of in over a week's time something might be happening down the eastern border, but that's a very long way off, and so there's a lot of uncertainty with that. But the across the top end, short term, yeah, picking up, and then the second burst into that Carpentaria district, so just the northern parts, we might see an increase.
Yep. For those living on the Gove Peninsula, are they likely to see a little bit more rain just even in the next 24 hours? Because the radar suggests there's a bit of moisture about.
Yeah, probably the next 24, 48 hours, the easing off Saturday, then coming back Sunday, Monday. So they're probably still going to see a bit of rain today. There's just that little line of showers just to the north of them. So, and there's looks like things are bubbling on the radar out over the water now and coming in. So I think it's probably going to continue all day.
Okay, then there is a strong wind warning in place today for the Roper Groote Coast. Is there anything else for the rest of the territory that you feel we should be aware of?
No, it's pretty quiet across the rest of the territory. Those strong winds will ease in the Gulf sort of later today, and then up in the northern parts of the Gulf of Carpentaria tomorrow, and they will extend east-westwards as that easterly surge moves through. But the rest of the territory is pretty quiet at the moment, just a bit windy, particularly through the Barkly. But that's probably the main point of interest. The temperature is a bit milder, and for those that don't want rain, so you're not likely to see any. Unfortunately, for those that do still want a little bit of top-up, you're out of luck.
Yeah, well, from what I can gather, I think most cattle stations are pretty happy with what the wet season has delivered for this season. And I see Alice Springs a top of 25 degrees today and tomorrow reaching a low of 6 degrees. Ooh, that's beanie weather.
Yep, I think it was 5.5 they got this morning, so they've had a pretty cold day, and probably just an indication of how cold it has been throughout the NT. So Alice Springs was 5.5, 12.4 down at Yulara, but once you get into the top end, 22.1 for Darwin and 20.5 for Middle Point, and Lunamar was 19.3. So we've had a few of those cooler temperatures even reaching into that rural area as well.
Thanks for your time this afternoon, Sally.
That's okay.
This week on Landline, regional Australia growing its own doctors to keep them in the bush.
There's very good evidence that if you do all of your medical school training in a rural setting and do your internship, you have a much higher chance of staying in a rural setting.
And burning invasive native scrub in an old coal-fired power station to create energy. That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
It is 12 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. We've just been sent a bit of news, a bit of good news about the Barkly Highway. I'll share that with you in just a moment. Now tell me, have you fallen victim to what's known as a business email compromise scam? Essentially, it's where a criminal hacks your email account and changes payment details on invoices to direct your money to them. If you've fallen for this, I guess have a bit of solace in that you are not alone, certainly not alone. This type of scam, this type of crime is on the rise. It appears to be impacting on farmers a lot. Angus Verley spoke to Roger Matthews, who is from Rabobank, who said that his company is getting a lot of reports coming in of soaring rates of cyber crime.
Well, fraud in Australia in 2022 was in excess of $3 billion. And one in particular, which is perhaps impacting most on farmers, is email interception and email fraud. That cost $250 million in 2022.
And we don't have the 2023 figures, but a fair assumption that those figures will rise substantially.
Oh, the trend is up. So the scammers continually get better, and we need to be one step ahead.
Just how susceptible are farmers and farm businesses to scams, given how complex they can be, just how much money is coming in and out, how many invoices are floating around, how susceptible are they particularly to scams?
The frequency is probably no different to the rest of society. The problem for agriculture as a whole is just how much money is involved. So actually, you might only get hit once or twice if you're unlucky. But if you're talking about an invoice that could be $10,000, $20,000, $150,000, and indeed I've had one client that was $300,000. So they can be really, really large sums.
Ed, we heard in this seminar about particularly business email compromise scams. Just explain what they are and how the scam actually works.
Well, typically they've got access to your email. They've somehow managed to find their way into your email, and they've typically set up a business rule. And a business rule that might say invoice or search for invoice and actually send it into another box. And then what they'll do is they will intercept an email that comes through from a legitimate provider to your business, and they'll change just one thing on that invoice. They'll change just the account, and they'll send it back through into your email. You're expecting the invoice to come through. It's for the right amount. All you have to do is change the account with which it's going to.
So I did hear about one farmer who he'd finished his shearing. He got a call a while later from his shearing contractor saying, "Oh, you haven't paid your invoice." He said, well, yes, I have. And it was exactly what you're saying, that the invoice or the bank details had been changed.
Dead right. So shearing contractors, you know, machinery dealers, parts, it happens frequently. And I think a key rule that we need to embed as a business practice is if ever there is a change of account details, is you've got to get on the phone. You've got to get on the phone to the supplier and actually confirm the account details before you send.
So that's a pain, I suppose, to have to do that when everyone's busy and it's an extra thing to do, but you say, too bad, you've just got to do it.
Dead right. Would you rather lose the money or take the 5 minutes to make the phone call?
And on that point, how much of an attitude do you think there is about, yeah, I know this happens, but it won't happen to me?
Yeah, look, I think false confidence is a bit of a concern. And look, I sat through a presentation with 12 clients. We actually talked about container invoice fraud and scams on containers. And Sandy was particularly quiet in that conversation. When we finished the presentation, Sandy got up and said, "You know what? I've been really good at picking the scams over a long period of time. I got done for this yesterday."
And so, as unfortunate as it is that it's a reality, you have to be really cynical about pretty much everything when it comes to finances?
Well, not everything. I think scams specifically.
Not what your bank's telling you?
Yeah. So I think we need to educate ourselves. And look, probably it's something that people can be a little bit embarrassed about. But the more we normalise this and increase awareness across public, it's going to help our understanding and our vigilance. So it does happen frequently. The chances of us being impacted are considerable. So we should be more comfortable to talk about and actually raise awareness across the board.
And on that point about normalising it, going back to those figures you said at the outset, they're lower than reality because scams are really highly unreported, probably because of that embarrassment factor to some extent.
Yeah, well, I think the figure we quoted was in excess of $3 billion, and it's probably estimated that a third of fraud is not reported. So you probably say that it's in excess of $4 billion, and the trend is upwards, as I said before.
That is Roger Matthews from Rabobank speaking to Angus Verley. And on the topic of online scams, for anyone who went to the NT Cattlemen's Association conference in Alice Springs, just have a listen to this. You may have already seen an email that came out from AAP Events. One of its staff's email has been hacked. And so attendees of the NTCA conference may have received an email that looks like it's come from AAP with the subject line FW for Ford, venue proposal 2024 NTCA Ladies Lunch. And that email has an attachment. The advice is please, please delete the email and do not open the attachment, whatever you do. So that's advice that's come from AAP Events. One of its staff have had their emails hacked, and you may have received that email about the venue proposal. Delete the email. Do not open the attachment.
So Jane has a complicated love life.
Hey, what's wrong with back hair?
Daddy, hibernation is over.
In a new ABC rom-com.
That is a lot of white meat.
No. They all just happen to be...
of the Caucasian persuasion.
Oh.
What kind of Korean are you?
Korean.
Can she fix the mess?
There is something seriously wrong with you. Ready?
Brand new comedy, White Fever.
Right, keep it in your pants.
Wednesday nights on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
Just quickly, some good news on the Barkly Highway. Travel will be allowed in both directions starting tomorrow at 6 o'clock in the morning. So for nearly 2 weeks, vehicles have only been allowed to drive on the Barkly for a few hours a day in one direction at a time. But the Department of Infrastructure has told us this afternoon that that restriction will be lifted tomorrow. So that's good news. There will still be a 13-axle limit, so no triple road trains still allowed. No overmass or oversized vehicles will be permitted, and high-clearance four-wheel drives are very much recommended. There's still a lot of water around the Barkly, and motorists will be advised to reduce their speed limits and drive to the conditions. The department says there's still water over the road and road damage at various sections of the highway. Contractors are continuing to undertake repairs. Motorists are advised to expect delays, drive to the conditions and comply with all traffic control. So there's a little update on the Barkly Highway. Kurundi Station, south of Tennant Creek, is as green as the fields of Ireland, according to its manager, after receiving a record amount of rain this year of nearly 1,000 millimetres. Kurundi Station was still fighting fires in January, but since then, it's rained and it's rained some more. And manager there, Ben Saint, says the pastures have bounced back beautifully and the water holes and creeks are full.
Everything's as wet as... we've seen it for a long time. There's springs in the middle of roads. There's water coming out of nooks and crannies in the hills.
How much rain have you had?
I think about 980 mil. So I would say it's a record. I haven't looked it up, but it's up there.
So 980 mil this year alone?
Yeah.
Gee, that's pretty good. Yeah. You must be happy with that. How nice is it after the fires last year?
Yeah, well, we smashed fires right through until about the 8th of January, and then it started to rain on the 12th of January and hasn't really stopped, to be honest with you. So I guess if I knew that it was going to get a 1,000 mil of rain, I would have stayed home during the fires, to be honest.
Fair enough. Is there still patches of black around the area, or has the rain really fallen over those areas that did get burnt?
No, it's been a blanket rain right across the whole place. I mean, there's areas that probably didn't quite get the, out towards communities, the rain gauges weren't as full as ours. And there was a couple of freak storms that came through that probably smudge overall rain over the whole property. Like down to the bottom end of the place is probably... yeah, nowhere near 1,000 mil of rain, but it's definitely as green and as covered flying around looking, you know, checking. Obviously, I can't get out there in a car, but flying around in the plane, there's a, you can tell where it has burnt, but it's definitely, you know, some places there, it's, you know, it's only half a metre high already, and then it's green. It's beautiful.
What was the area that did burn in those fires?
Well, basically it followed, well, three of my boundaries right around. We were able to keep it at bay right until the very end, and we probably lost, I think, about 700-800 square kilometres in total of Kurrumbi, but it pretty much followed three boundaries of the station. So, yeah, did have, until rain, a very good fire break.
Yeah, well, speaking of, now that that rain's come and there is lots of grass growth, as you said, are you concerned about fire seasons coming up?
Oh, definitely, yeah. No, we've already had that conversation with Bushfires Council already, in the fact that, you know, what's meant to be a seven-year spell, and some of the, I made a mention when I actually got a fire burn permit yesterday to try and patch burn places that didn't burn during the fire season, which is, you know, the fuel loading now is enormous, but, you know, fires are definitely a threat because of the amount of rain we've had.
Are you putting in, you said you're, you know, doing back burning, but are you going to be putting in any brakes or doing anything as well?
I wouldn't say we've started brakes. It's a bit, yeah, like literally, the best way to explain it, it's our access road's still 4x4 only, high clearance, and there's for a very good reason. Like, we went grading to try and do some flood work, and we got the grader bulked within about half an hour. So we've parked that idea up for a little while, but patch burning, like getting around on a motorbike and just patch burning some of the areas because it is so green and wet. The patch burning isn't what I would class as a success in a good year, like in a normal, but it's burning various little areas out, which is all I need to do, and what we've done earlier, halfway through, like we started patch burning in February, and that's already green and you know, it's probably, it's established grass already going back on it, but nowhere near this thicker bloody growth is what it was. So, yeah, we just patch burning out and before it dries out too much, and we've ended up with a big bushfire.
So, you know, obviously, like we said, the grass growth is a risk for fires, but also, you know, the positives, it's going to be great for the cattle. How is the rain impacting things and the grass impacting things in that sense?
Well, I guess we had early storms, November, December, we had some storms, so the cattle, most of our sale cattle were still, we're already standing on green grass. I wouldn't say it was as good as what it is now, but they were standing on green grass, so they've now been standing or have access to green grass right through now for, 5-6 months. So definitely weight gains has been incredible, and the growth, you know, the cattle, the calves, the weaners, the cows are, you know, in good health. But our sale cattle have now had access to green grass now for close on 6 months. So it's incredible. It's one of those things that, you know, when you're in the midst of fire and you've got charcoal on your brow, that you'd, when the early storms did start to come through, you were grateful, but we were still preoccupied by lightning strikes because of those storms. It was probably their main reason why we were fighting so many fires, but where the rains did fall and the grass grew, so the cattle, everything is probably a good a heart as what you could imagine Kurrumbi to ever look like. And it's, in some cases, I've often said there's probably too much rain in some of the swamps and areas. It's starting to die off because it's such waterlogged, but, you know, it'll keep growing. It's not a bad problem. It's one of those things, the growth of the trees, the growth of the grass, it's an amazing thing to see.
And what's next coming up for you in terms of jobs that you'll be doing around the place?
Yeah, we'll get around, make sure, because of the nature of the lay of the land, there's a lot of floodgates to do, but same thing, in saying that, the lay of the rain has just been a steady flow, so the rivers aren't busting its banks and as you would get like 100 mil in 10 minute type storms. It's been, you know, 10 mils every day for 10 days. So the rivers are full, flowing. The fences, you know, are our probably main concern, and then we're going to have to get some serious fire breaks and access roads graded up. But, you know, I can't see that we'll have too many loaded road trains now for another, you know, couple of months yet before we get back to, you know, carting huge numbers of cattle around just for them to get bogged otherwise. But, no, to see the country respond to what it is now is pretty damn incredible. And the rivers, the water holes and everything are going to be full now for several years, which is a good sign. Or it's, you know, it's easy to manage a cattle station when it's raining.
That is Ben Saint, who's the station manager there at Corundi, which is about 100 kilometres to the south of Tennant Creek. He was speaking to Victoria Ellis. What an incredible turnaround after those awful bushfires. That's all we've got time for on today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.